Marshall and Sagar here. Welcome back to The Realignment.
Republicans get to 2017. They haven't done the hard work because it would have been hard. You know, it would have been complicated. They would have had to do something about the fact that, well, half this party like thinks the welfare state should like be blown out of existence. Half the party is like, oh, well, you know, maybe we should keep some parts because my constituents like it. And like there was part of the party that frankly just didn't care. There's in general, I have quotes from Republicans like, Republicans don't do healthcare. They don't care about healthcare. And that's like not me. That's like former Republican staffers saying that. And then meanwhile, the whole time you have Republicans promising this great alternative, especially Trump.
Our last two shows focused on China and the U.S. in the future and China and the U.S. during the Obama, Trump, and Biden administrations. We are going to take a complete pivot, focus entirely on the opposite end of the policy and politics spectrum, and focus on Obamacare. We brought Jonathan Cohn of the Huffington Post to talk about his new book, The 10-Year War, Obamacare and the Unfinished Crusade for Universal Coverage. Now, it seems like a show that's doing everything from covering nuclear war of China to covering Obamacare is being a little too ambitious. But here's why this story really matters, which Jonathan gets to in the book, which we highly recommend. Go to our bookshop, of course. And then also in this interview, Obamacare was the defining political issue of the 2010s when it came to politics and policy. Why was it that President Obama lost control of the House in 2010? Obamacare. Why did Democrats transition from a party that had a lot of conservatives in the South and in the Midwest in states like Nebraska? Obamacare. Why did Mitch McConnell become one of the defining figures of opposition during this period? Obamacare. How did the Trump presidency first start to tilt in the wrong direction when it came to implementing policy? Very quickly, the inability of Republicans to come together around repealing Obamacare despite promises to the contrary. So this is a super important issue that you need to understand if you understand where our politics is going forward.
This one's something I loved about talking with Jonathan was just how he has been involved in this literally from the very beginning. Wrote a book on healthcare in 2007. He was in the White House Rose Garden during a healthcare press conference, in the congressional hearings. He has a deep set of knowledge here. And I actually say this in the episode. I'm like, I don't feel like most people know anything whenever it comes to healthcare and are mostly just posturing. And he actually does. Really helped me understand the political developments around the defining feature, really, of my adult political life, which, as he points out, basically just disappeared after the Republican failure in order to repeal Obamacare. It's a defining moment, truly, in American politics that we are here today and that we're really not even really talking about healthcare in the same way. There's a lot to be learned about where things will head for the future.
And something I was thinking about during this episode is it may come off as if we are just cheerleading Obamacare and the Democrats and everything. And if that happens, if you get that perception, it's because Jonathan hits a very accurate point. The story of Obamacare on the Republican side is one of policy unambition. It's a story of failure, and it's a story of politicians who are more incentivized around getting Fox News hits than actually focusing on issues. Yeah. The real story here is that regardless of how you think Obamacare turned out, regardless of whether you think healthcare is a human right or not, regardless of whether you think we need Medicare for all, the reason why Obamacare is able to pass and then survive the 10 years of challenges is because Democrats were focused on, for almost a century, passing some form of coverage in that sort. So if you are a Republican who is ticked off of this episode, who thinks we're going too easy on Jonathan and on Obamacare, A, I'll remind you all, we are not healthcare policy experts, but B, I would suggest you take that anger and energy and direct it towards actually coming up with a Republican articulation of what the healthcare system should look like, because the clear lesson from this decade is the following. Saying you don't just want Obamacare and saying you just want to repeal, not worry about replacing it, is insufficient and is going to lead to an actual disaster that even your own voters are going to reject. So that is the homework for every single Republican who is not happy with us this episode.
Okay, as we mentioned, please make sure you go ahead and check out our bookshop, which is in the show notes. You can purchase Jonathan's book. You can purchase Josh Rogan's book, any of the previous ones that we've had here on the podcast. We've noticed you guys have just been buying a ton of really excellent and quality books. We want you guys to keep it up. Check out the link in our show notes or in our Substack.
And a quick thing, a couple of people called us on YouTube, so thank you for noticing. We started putting out specific bookshop lists for every single show that we did. So for Josh Rogan, we had a US-China bookshop link. For Admiral Stavridis, we had a Admiral Stavridis bookshop link. And for today's show, we have a universal healthcare / Obamacare / healthcare reform link as well too. So go to that if you're looking to learn specifically more about this topic so you could come at us with questions about everything that we missed or didn't properly cover.
All right, let's get to the question and answer period.
Quick reminder, leave us a 5-star review with a question or email us at realignmentpod@gmo.com. Today's question comes from MillerKey061. Love the show. Thanks for the great work that you do, Marshall and Sagar. It feels like many conservatives I know have become increasingly skeptical and hostile to big business for culture war reasons, but that doesn't seem to have translated to support for labor unions or other counterbalancing institutions. Is there an opportunity for opinions on labor issues to be realigned by way of the culture wars? I'm interested in what circumstances would be required for a broader shift in attitudes on the topic. Thanks.
Great question. And I think you have already basically seen an answer in terms of what happened with Senator Marco Rubio. And the key thing is Marco Rubio came out and basically said, unions are mostly bad. I generally don't support them. I don't support structural changes in the U.S. economy to strengthen unions. But I hate Amazon because it's woke. Therefore, in this case, I support unions against Amazon as a punitive measure. Now, there's not a lot of ideological coherence that's going on in that statement. And there's the reason is that it's purely based within the culture war. So whether there's a realigning opinion around unions or not, if it does materialize in any way, it will be Republicans supporting unions only against companies that they don't like. And ideologically, I just don't see how that can really stand the test of time. So in my opinion, I do not think there is going to be some grand realignment whenever it comes to actual union policy, as in what happens at the National Labor Relations Board under the future Republican president.
And this is the key thing. When we even talk about Republicans supporting those unions, it means an op-ed in a paper, right? So we don't mean Republicans are going to show up and picket and support anything. Look at what happened with Representative Madison Cawthorn recently. He decided to join in on Amazon dunking on Bernie Sanders for a variety of simple yet weirdly complicated reasons. So that's the broader thing there. I appreciate how the questioner understands the culture war over everything point they were trying to make here. And look, one other broader thing that you should think about, the reason why the debate about unions basically only matters for Democrats is the following. The people who run the companies, the management, they're Democrats. The workers who are actually picketing in the first place, they are also Democrats. We talked about this with Alec McGillis a week ago, so definitely go back and listen to that episode. But the reality is that these unionization fights tend to be blue state battles, of which Republicans basically have nothing to say or add. Showing, and I actually realized that this all happened in Georgia, but broadly speaking,
Alabama.
This happened in Alabama, so that isn't a blue state per se, but I definitely think the management and everything, most of the workers were probably Democrats. So there just isn't a key valence for why Republican perspectives either way on this would matter.
That's a good point. All right, as always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate all the work they let us do here. Let's dive in.
Jonathan Cohn, welcome to The Realignment.
Oh, thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited.
Good to see you, Jonathan.
Good to see you as well.
I love it when we interview people on topics who've covered a topic at different time periods so we can then cover both ends, then start in the middle. So right before the start of the Obama presidency, you wrote a book called Sick, The Untold Story of America's Healthcare Crisis and the People Who Pay the Price. Let's start here. What was your diagnosis of what was wrong with the American healthcare system right before the Obama presidency?
Yeah. So actually, diagnosis is a nice metaphor, both because it's medical, but also I think that's a good way to think of it. I mean, the symptoms, let's talk about the symptoms real quick. I mean, you had a ton of people without health insurance. You had people with health insurance that didn't feel secure. They had high deductibles. They couldn't afford their premiums. The whole system was getting more expensive. There was really no way to control it. It was a disorganized mess. My diagnosis was we lacked a universal healthcare system, and in particular, something that looked like one of the systems abroad. I always remind people there's different varieties. If you go to different countries in Europe, you'll see a bunch of different systems, and some have a role for private insurance, some it's all public, some they're like utilities, but they all kind of have the same basic characteristics. And so I thought we needed to get to one of those systems where everybody has insurance and no one has punishing out of pocket costs, and the government has kind of some kind of handle on spending so that, you know, we're not, you know, forking over so much money for what is, by as best as anyone can tell, not a better healthcare system.
So here's what I want to get with, which is because there's a lot of posturing whenever it comes to healthcare. And what I really realize is, like, most people have no idea what they're talking about. So what actually did Obamacare do? No rhetoric, none of that. What was the state of the American healthcare system pre-Obamacare? Numbers of uninsured, the biggest problems that we had, et cetera. And then what did it actually do?
And so, to add one thing to that, what did it try to do? Because there's two different, like, so right. So, like, let's start with what did it try to do?
Yeah.
And then we'll get to Sagar's specifics around, like, what actually happened.
Yeah. So I would, if we're going to just be really simplistic about it, it was an attempt to get us close to a universal healthcare system, both by helping more people to get insurance and make their insurance more affordable, and also to put in place systems and principles that any universal coverage system should have, recognizing from the outset it wouldn't get all the way there. I mean, we can talk about why. Yeah. And my simplistic answer is, did it do that? Well, I think it actually did, with the very important qualification that it didn't reach as many people, didn't make insurance as affordable, and didn't establish as many of those principles as they originally hoped.
So let's return a little bit in terms of the diagnosis there, and maybe a little bit you can expand on the work you did in SICK, which is that what was the political impetus for that? Because I do think it's been long enough that, you know, so many of our listeners are, you know, Zoomers, they're like 18, 19, they literally probably can't even conceive, or they were children whenever this was happening. That state of the healthcare system pre-Obama, what was it in terms of price, in terms of, like, middle class, poor, uninsured dynamics? Lay some of that out.
Yeah, well, I'm really glad you asked that, because actually that was a big motivation of the book, was a sense there were a lot of people who were talking about this and had, you know, either they had forgotten, or they never were, you know, or like you said, they were younger and never experienced what life was like before the Affordable Care Act. So, you know, first of all, you had more people who were low income and could not pay for insurance. People who, most of them were working actually, but, you know, they had part-time jobs, they had low paying jobs, they had service jobs that did not provide benefits, and they had no way to get coverage. You then had a whole class of people who had some kind of pre-existing medical condition, and they did not, they weren't necessarily, maybe they were middle income, you know, they were making a decent wage, but for whatever reason, they did not have insurance available through the workplace. So they had to go buy it on their own. And in most states, although not all, if you tried to buy insurance on your own and you had a pre-existing condition, either the company would tell you, we're going to charge you a lot more, we're not going to pay for anything related to your pre-existing condition. And just think about that for a second. Imagine your pre-existing condition is diabetes. That's like, yes, almost anything you could show up, you know, at the doctor's office or hospital for. Or we're just not going to give you coverage at all. And on top of that, the coverage, when you did buy it, it frequently had big gaps in it. And you wouldn't discover these usually until it was too late. Because, I mean, no one knew how to read through these insurance. There was no standardization. Mm-hmm. And just to give you a real life example, you know, I remember interviewing a family, and this was a reasonably well-off family. You know, husband worked in a financial firm, had a good paying job. But the insurance policy had an annual limit on benefits of like $1 million. If you went over $1 million a year in charges, the policy didn't cover it anymore. Well, they had a baby, and the baby had a congenital heart condition, treatable, thankfully, but required surgeries and medications, and they hit that $1 million cap within a few months. So this, mm-hmm, is, you know, your middle class person with insurance, and you can't afford your coverage. The whole system's getting more expensive, and there's really no way to control it. And so you had all of those problems. And they were facts of life. They had been for decades.
I want to focus on two things here. One, you've repeatedly referenced cost. And as I understand it as a non-expert in the space, the American healthcare system is still much more, it's still continuously incredibly expensive. So what, and this feeds into conversations about death panels and all the greatest 2010, 2011 hits, but basically what did Obamacare try to do with bending the cost curve? And then what basically took us to today with the fact that the system is still much more expensive than the actual outcomes are for people, regardless of whether they're covered or not?
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, just to give a little bit of background here, we are way more expensive than other countries. And the simplest reason is that every other country is part of their national health insurance system. The government is somehow involved in sort of setting the prices. You know, they either say, they set like a global budget, like this year, the country of France is going to spend X, not dollars, francs, you know, whatever, you know, German marks, if you're in Germany, this is how much we're spending on healthcare this year. And we're going to divvy it up. We're not going to spend more, or we'll, if it goes up, then we have to raise taxes, whatever. But there's some kind of control, and or they just, you know, they dictate prices. Okay, this is how much a knee replacement is going to cost. And, you know, this is what doctor's visit is going to cost. We have nothing like that, right? I mean, we've never had that because we don't have an organized system. For a very long time in the United States, when we would debate universal healthcare, going back to Harry Truman's day, no, the idea was, okay, if we do that, if we have a universal healthcare system, we too will have the government setting prices. Get up to where, you know, you get to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, that idea is like not on the radar screen anymore. It's been rejected. It's partly a political thing. The country, you know, we're coming out of the Reagan era. This is still a very conservative country. We don't believe in government. Partly it's an intellectual. I mean, even on the Democratic side of the aisle, there's a real enthusiasm for this idea that, you know, the free market can solve our problems and competition is going to solve our problems. And there's a lot of interest in kind of getting to the liberal goal of universal coverage through conservative means. So for those reasons and a bunch, you know, some others as well, the theory is, all right, we're not going to control prices. We're not going to set a global budget. It's too hard to do. No one, you know, it's too hard to fight the industry, whatever. So instead, though, we're going to try to, there is this realization, really important, that not only is American healthcare expensive, but it's like inefficient in all kinds of ways. And what they decided they thought they could do is, let's figure out all the ways, all the levers we have in our healthcare system, a lot of which involve the Medicare program. And how can we encourage the system to move in the direction of more efficient care? And the theory was, look, Medicare is, you know, we don't have control. We can't get our arms around the whole healthcare system and all of its spending. But, you know, Medicare is like a really big chunk of it. Every hospital in America relies heavily on Medicare. Medicare announces it's going to start paying for something differently. Hospitals are going to respond. They can't just ignore it. So there's a lot of experimentation in Medicare in terms of like, okay, what do we know? What do we need to do? Like, you know, can we get hospitals to focus more on like cutting down on infections, which is like something you should be able to cut down on inside the hospital. It doesn't take a lot of know-how. A small hospital can do it as well as a big hospital. And, you know, if you cut down on infections in a hospital, it's going to cut down on follow-up care. It's going to cut down cost. So let's figure out ways to like penalize hospitals or, you know, that have high infection rates, or reward hospitals that have low infection rates, things like that. And really to kind of, I mean, the theory was very much we have a lot of ideas about what might work. We're not sure which ones are going to make the most difference. So let's try a bunch of them, throw everything at the wall, kind of in a pilot program, see what works, and then double down on those. And then there were some other bigger kind of, I don't want to say clumsier, but cruder ways to cut costs. So one of them was they just cut a bunch of money out of Medicare that was going to private insurance companies that contracted with Medicare. They just said, hey, we're going to pay you less. And they actually went to the hospitals and said, you know what? You guys can make do with less. We're just going to cut, you know, your productivity adjustments. And then, you know, they changed, or they tried to change, then it got repealed. The sort of way the tax code treats health insurance, which was something all the economists were very big on because they thought this was a really good way to control costs. Became very controversial and ended up getting repealed. But so it was basically this sort of multifaceted effort to do that.
Got it.
I'm really interested in the political context that all of the wonky healthcare stuff plays out in, which is, and I'm sure you've seen this and think about this in your reporting today, there's this emerging consensus that despite the Biden administration's lack of flash it has the opportunity to be a transformative presidency, especially by not being hobbled by critiques and worries about deficit spending. Larry Summers-ish thought, very centrist neoliberal thinking of the 1990s. In many ways, Obamacare comes into this critique of whether or not the Obama presidency was ambitious or aggressive enough when it came to pursuing change. Given all of that context, and given that, and we'll talk about this a little later, American politics really came to center on Obamacare. And in many ways, you could argue that the result of that, aka the Republican takeover of the House, the partisanship, the Tea Party, et cetera, hobbled the presidency. Do you think if you're a Democrat, Obamacare was worth it?
Yeah. So I absolutely think it was sort of the defining political chapter. And that's a very self-serving thing of me to say, because I just wrote a book saying that's all part of the book.
I would hope you would say that.
I was like, thank you for the advertisement of my book.
Yeah.
But I feel like in many ways, it was this sort of case study that has provided the lessons that the Biden administration has now learned and put to work, in no small part because a lot of the people in the Biden administration were the people who were, you know, there last time around. They're like, okay, don't do that again. Do Democrats think it's the wrong thing to do? I can't speak for what's in various heads of various members or people. I would think most of them actually think it's worth it. And I think this speaks to why it got done. And it's the most boring reason ever, which is that Democrats care about this. Universal healthcare is like in the DNA of the Democratic Party, has been since Harry Truman's day. It flows naturally from the party, the liberal instinct, right? Which when you think about it, I mean, what is that instinct? It's number one, we take care of people at their moments of vulnerability, right? I mean, why are you a liberal? Why are you a Democrat? Why are you a progressive? I mean, that's gotta be part of it. That's why you're doing it. You think that's a moral imperative. And not only do you think it's a moral imperative, but you have a fairly clear idea of how you get there, which is that you recognize that every one of us is vulnerable. Every one of us can be a victim of bad luck, misfortune, even if it's not just luck, even if we sometimes make our own misfortune. Point is, people have moments when they're vulnerable, and an enlightened society, a good society, recognizes that and says, you know what? We're going to protect people, and we're going to protect people by everyone pooling together. It's in everyone's interest to be part of this mutual security scheme. I mean, I draw the analogy very deliberately to Social Security, what it was all about. What was Social Security all about? It's recognized, hey, we're all going to get old, hopefully. You know, we all need help when we know time. So we all pay into the system. That was the premise of Medicare, right? Now we all need, well, the Affordable Care Act, it doesn't look like those programs for a complex set of political reasons. Again, I go over in the book, but the animating spirit behind it was that. And, you know, if you're a Democrat, chances are, like, that's why you got into the business. And, you know, and there's so many moments, but I think the one that really stands out to me, there's a moment late in the debate when they're sort of getting close to passing the Affordable Care Act. And there's been these ups and downs, and it came so close to falling apart so many times, but they're on the verge of getting the votes. And Obama speaks to the House Democratic Caucus. And by this point, the thing is pretty unpopular, okay? And you can kind of read the tea leaves. We're into 2010. It does not take a genius to see that a lot of these Democrats could lose seats. A lot of them are in vulnerable districts, you know? And he's basically saying to them, he's saying, like, this is why you got elected, to do this. You know, this is why you're here. It's because you believed there would be a moment when you'd get a chance to do something like this. And he says that, and they vote, you know, and a lot of them do. I mean, believe me, plenty of them knew they were not going to win re-election, that this would be their undoing, and they thought it was worth it. And I always say, I mean, do they think it's worth it? You know, obviously you'd have to ask of them, but I do think, and I don't want to jump ahead in our conversation, but I think one of the reasons Democrats were able to get their healthcare legislation across the finish line in 2010, and Republicans were not able to get their healthcare legislation across the finish line in 2017, we're trying to repeal the Affordable Care Act, because they did not feel that sense of purpose. I mean, they really, you know, they all wanted to undo Obama's legacy, and they didn't like the war. But it was not like they did not have this burning desire to do this. And I think that's, you know, I would think most Democrats today, even the ones who lost their seats, would say, yeah, we're glad we did this.
I think you're absolutely right on that front. And I think it tells you a lot that they did do it for tax cuts, but that's a whole other podcast. One thing I want to get with you, and I think this is very important, In the retconning from Republican and Democrats, what went wrong for the Democrats in the Democratic version of the backlash to Obamacare? So if I were Barack Obama and I'm pontificating today, what did I do wrong about the rise of the Republicans? And if I'm a Republican, maybe like the current House leadership or something, what is the narrative in my head for why we won in 2010? And then in your opinion, which is the correct one?
Yeah, yeah. So I can definitely answer the first one because I asked President Obama as my interview.
We'll link that in the show notes.
You know, and actually, I would say that the Democratic, his version of what went wrong is a little different than what you hear from other Democrats. I mean, among things, there's still some lingering tension, I think, between him and the progressive wing of the party over what the mistakes were. But in general, talking to, you know, Democrats, what they get wrong. So, I mean, I think there's a general consensus, although there's an interesting exception to this. If you want, I'll tell you about it. That the process took too long. You know, the point they had tried to go quickly. They wanted to go quickly. At least that was the goal, was to go quickly. The original calendar had them getting, you know, bills passed before the August recess of 2009, so they could put it all together and pass a final legislation early fall of 2009. They still, you know, Obama was wanted to still do a climate bill, and they wanted to look at financial reform, and they had very ambitious plans. The whole thing actually ends up dragging out to the following March. So I think there's a feeling that they waited too long. The reason they waited too long is they were trying to negotiate and get Republicans on board. That really dragged the thing out. So I think there's some of that was what they got wrong. I think there was related to that, and Obama absolutely said this, was a sort of misjudging of how hostile the Republicans would be. I mean, none of them ever thought that like Mitch McConnell was going to walk up and say, I love this healthcare plan. Yeah, this is my thing. Of course that wasn't going to happen. But I think they felt like, you know, they were starting with a plan deliberately that had its roots in something that, you know, in a Republican governor's plan from Massachusetts, and had borrowed liberally, maybe not the best word to use, but borrowed liberally from places like the Heritage Foundation. I think they felt like they would get some Republican buy-in, and they never did, except for one senator who voted in committee for it, but that's it.
Real quick, Jonathan, I want to pick up there because it gets to a frustration that I have with the rhetoric around Romney Care in 2006, and then the fact that the Heritage Foundation wrote a white paper. I spent a lot of time in conservative think tanks in Washington, D.C., and I just, help me understand if that belief is in good faith of Heritage wrote a paper, because I don't think anyone who spends any time in center-right D.C. would believe that a random scholar writing a report has any sway or weight with Republican voters or Republican elected officials, right? So for example, you know, like we started this podcast at the Hudson Institute, a conservative think tank in DC. A Hudson Institute scholar once wrote a paper saying he favors a carbon tax, which, great, sure, like let's have a conversation there. But if you are a Democrat and you look at the existence of that track record of white papers that probably five people read, it seems insane to me that you would assume that that says something broadly about the party and where its voters and elected officials actually are. So can you just talk about that environment? Because this has always just seemed intuitive to me that that wouldn't be true.
Yeah, yeah. So let me agree in part and then disagree in part. So the agree in part is that I do think there's a mythology that's built up around this where, you know, and the mythology goes like this. Democrats adopted the Heritage Foundation plan as their healthcare plan, and Republicans all turned on it when they used to support it. Well, no, right? I mean, obviously that wasn't. And in fact, and in the book, I talk about, you know, one of their huge differences. You know, the Massachusetts health plan, which is, you know, was the Romney plan in Massachusetts, that, you know, one of the biggest differences between that and the Affordable Care Act was the Romney plan you didn't have to raise money for. Because of the circumstances in Massachusetts, and this was in fact a big reason why they got it done, they didn't have to raise revenue, which is always the hard part. So, you know, obviously you were having a huge tax increase that was going with the Affordable Care Act. Of course, you're going to lose a lot of Republicans on that. So let's not oversell that for sure. Yeah. Having said all that, I think it was more than just a think tank. You know, it was more than just a paper by Stuart Butler, who is the Heritage Foundation scholar. First of all, again, and something that's very important to remember, the entire Obama healthcare effort takes place in the long shadow of the failure of the Clinton healthcare effort in the early 90s. And that it was, and in fact, in writing the book and researching it, it became more convinced of what a defining episode that was. And there's two chapters in the book on it because it burned these deep scars and lessons into how the Democrats acted. And if you go back to the history of 93, there was a moment early when it really, they could have probably negotiated and come up with a something bipartisan with some of the Republicans there. You were already seeing the Republican Party change from where it had been, but you had a number of moderates in the party, and there was a real sense that you could deal with that kind of moderate wing of the party. Now, obviously that wing had shrunk by 2009, but it was not that long ago. It was only in 2003, 2004 that you had Republicans doing the Medicare Part D, the drug benefit for Medicare, and that had been partly bipartisan. And then just a year or two before, Democrats and Republicans had gotten together to pass bills reauthorizing the Children's Health Insurance Program. And you know, one of the things in the book, I mean, I sort of recount these meetings. I got to see some notes from where like Charles Grassley and Orrin Hatch were sort of talking to Democratic lawmakers. And I'd never heard this before. I learned that Orrin Hatch had actually, you know, this, who was a senator from Utah, very conservative, but had a really strong personal relationship with Ted Kennedy, had actually dispatched his staff to Kennedy's staff, said, let's try to do something together. So I don't think it was as crazy an idea as it looks now, that they would be able to get some buy-in. And, you know, it really is not until 2009, 2010, that the party as a whole just turns against universal coverage in principle. You know, until that time, you had members, prominent members who were like, we can do this, we can work with this. I think looking back, it was wistful, it was unrealistic. I think any bill that could have gotten Orrin Hatch and Charles Grassley, who were two of the Senate leaders at the time and the Republican on board, would have been so much smaller than what the Democrats wanted. It would probably have never taken off.
Yeah.
But it was a lot less crazy than it seems now, I guess is what I'm saying.
So one quick thing on this, Sagar, because I'm fascinated by this debate. If I'm thinking about Medicare Part D, so for seniors, the Children's Health Program, all those issues, those were issues where it was obviously to Republicans' advantage to support them. There's this whole debate during the Bush era about, wow, we became big government Republicans in order to buy senior votes in Ohio. So in the case of Medicare Part D, it wasn't as if there was this big ideological transformation in the Republican Party thinking, well, we know Reagan spoke out against all this stuff, but now we support this idea. It really was, and maybe this is a parody and this is me just watching too much Daily Show during the, you know, 2000s, but it's Karl Rove's political apparatus believing this was a beneficial thing for the administration to push because of their need to win over seniors and actually win in 2004. So in the cases you're describing as Republicans offering good faith working in favor of something, it's because it politically benefited them. What political benefit, and this is pure cynicism, right? What political benefit would there have been for Republicans in working with Democrats on Obamacare, right? Because that's where this gets into the complicated part of it.
No. So, I mean, I think this gets exactly to the transition I'm sort of trying to chronicle here that happens during the Affordable Care Act fight, which is that I think, you know, on the merits, right, if you're in a pre-2009 world, it's not crazy to think that if you're Charles, well, so let's put ourselves in the mind of Charles Grassley. You're from Iowa. Iowa's a conservative, straight moving, more conservative, but it's not that conservative, right? And it's got lots of independent business owners, people who struggle to get health insurance, right? It's got lots of people who need Medicaid. And, you know, if I'm Charles Grassley, a bunch of my low-income people in my state get health insurance. My hospitals are happy. I got people with pre-existing conditions. They can't find insurance. I mean, the genuine merits of the plan, if you believe it's a good plan, then, you know, you would believe that, you know, Iowans could benefit from something like that. And what I think was not accounted for, in part because it was still new, and you know, maybe it should have been, you know, maybe Democrats were slow on the draw here. And I try in the book hard not to overly second guess people because I just think this stuff is complicated and it always looks clearer in hindsight. But maybe they should have known. But I mean, the sort of rise of this attachment to the fact that it's Obama, we're going to oppose it no matter what. I mean, we saw this at the beginning with the stimulus, right? I mean, there was a feeling, at least with the stimulus, that it won't be so hard to get, because of course, you know, and you know, we have a bunch of tax cuts to lick, and just the rules had changed, and it took the Democrats a while to figure that out. And in retrospect, they should have figured it out before, but I can imagine why Democrats at the time didn't think they'd change as much as they did. And I also think, frankly, I think you can't divorce any of this without understanding the role that race played in this, in firing up the Republican base and in the sort of I always say that I feel like the opposition to Obamacare was as much about the Obama part as it was about the care part. And when we're talking about Obama, some of that's just pure partisanship, right? I mean, it's nothing more than that. But I think some of that, you know, I think just the evidence is compelling that there was a racial subtext to some of it. There is an anxiety there that his election provoked and that fed into it. And it was a kind of perfect storm in a lot of ways, but you got to a situation where, you know, by the summer of 2009, you had to be against this thing. Period. Yeah. End of story. And once that was true, you were out of a world where you could negotiate with Republicans. Although, again, I was trying to remind people were like, oh, they spent so long negotiating with Republicans. If they hadn't, they could have gotten a better bill. And I just said that. So I think that's at least partly true. But the hard part wasn't getting the Republicans. It was getting the conservative Democrats on board or keeping mm-hmm. them on board. You know, it was the Ben Nelsons. It was the Blanche Lincolns from Arkansas. You know,
what was the Nebraska call thing? Cornhusker?
The Cornhusker kickback.
Yeah.
See, now that's an interesting. Yeah, that's it. So, yeah. I mean, that really speaks to the political challenge they face. So, yeah. You know, Ben Nelson. Ben Nelson's a Democratic senator from Nebraska. Nebraska, right? I mean, Nebraska is a deeply red state by this point. But, you know, the Democrats, you know, are holding on to a bunch of seats like this where they have members who they're incumbents or somehow they figured out how to survive in these red states, but they got deeply skeptical voters, right? And so they're very nervous about, they don't want to seem like they're too close to Democratic leadership and they don't want to seem like they're endorsing big government. So a big part of the Affordable Care Act is we're going to expand Medicaid, right? I mean, you know, Medicaid prior to 2009 in most states, it was, you know, there was a core group who had to be eligible for it if the state wanted to offer it. So like young children, pregnant women, but then whether you expanded beyond that was completely at state discretion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if you lived in Maryland or you lived in California or, you know, Massachusetts, like the states were aggressive, they would expand it to more people, but Nebraska, no. So the deal was as originally written, basically states would expand, you know, the states would expand Medicaid to cover everybody who lived below the poverty line or just above it. So really like universal healthcare for the poor, you know, that was the deal. And the federal government was going to pick up most of the extra costs, but some of it would have to come from the states. There were conservatives who argued this is a bad deal for the states because states are going to have to pony up extra money. I myself, having looked at a lot of the studies, think the other argument, which is that states ended up better off. They got more than they gave, and the resulting economic growth pretty much made it a wash, or even they came out ahead. I think that was persuasive, but whatever. You had a lot of conservatives who didn't like this. So Ben Nelson's like, I think the Medicaid, you know, either the Medicaid expansion should be optional or the federal government should pick up the entire cost.
Yeah.
And basically Harry Reid, like this, this is literally vote number 60. He's got 59 Democrats and we're in a 60 vote world because it's not like people were talking about getting rid of the filibuster back then. And he's like, I can either not get the 60th vote or I can give Ben Nelson some cover. So they decide that, you know, they can't afford to have the federal government pick up the whole cost in every state. That would blow up the price tag on the bill. But, you know, Nebraska's a pretty small state. So it's like, throw it in there. And, you know, it became this scandal, the corner. It was a giveaway to Nebraska, which it was. To be fair, every piece of major legislation in the history of the United States has had, you know, that kind of stuff. And really, I think any reasonable accounting of the Affordable Care Act, put it alongside, say, the Medicare drug bill, which was a Republican bill, had relatively few of these giveaways in it. And a lot of them, you know, like there was extra money for Medicaid in Louisiana. Now, was that to get Mary Landrieu's vote? Yeah. But did they actually need it? Yeah, because they were still a couple of years past Katrina and the whole public health system in Louisiana had been wiped out. I mean, you didn't really feel bad about giving Louisiana a special deal on its healthcare because they were still rebuilding from Katrina. So, you know, but yeah, it was a big scandal. And the thing is, it became this big controversy. And, you know, Nelson, interestingly enough, even with that deal predicted, he said, this is the end of my political career in Nebraska. And he was right. He was way down in the polls after that. And he didn't run for reelection. Of course, now it's a Republican in that seat.
Right. It's so fascinating just to relive some of this stuff. Just for audience context and yours, I was an intern at the time for Chet Edwards, RIP, who was a Democrat from my hometown, College Station, who represented the most Republican district of any Democrat. It was like R plus 35 in terms of what it was. And he actually ended up voting against Obamacare and still lost by the largest margin of any House. And he's exactly who you're talking about there, who they just simply didn't know what was going on. It's so funny in terms of what you were talking about a little bit earlier with Obama. I think he just dramatically underestimated the backlash to like Obama himself and really what he embodied to a lot of people. And I found it fascinating. In his own book, he grapples with this a little bit, where he was like, you know, the moment I made that comment about Henry Louis Gates, and I think it was right around the same time as what this happened, my numbers plummeted with working class whites, and I never recovered from that. And I always thought, oh, go ahead, Marshall.
Yeah, quick thing, because I did a double take when you said it. Chet Edwards is still alive.
To anyone who's still listening.
I meant political RIP. Chet Edwards, just quick fact check, Chet Edwards is still alive. But yeah,
Chet's
let's take
fine.
It back to Obama.
I hear he's doing well down in down in Baylor. That's where he probably always wanted to do well.
Can I say something about that press conference, though?
Go ahead.
I didn't interrupt that. But like, I was there at that press conference. Had never been to a primetime White House press conference. I have never since been to a White House. That was my one time at a White House press conference. Yeah. And I remember because I was very excited to be invited. And, you know, I was, and they sat me in the front row. I was like, it was like the networks were like Jake Tapper and Chuck Todd and And then it was like me. And he was going down the row. And I'm pretty sure I was there because at that point they already knew me as someone who covers healthcare. That press conference was supposed to all be about healthcare. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure they had me there because they figured correctly, I'd probably ask a wonky question. I know what I thought was a really good question to us. So remember, it was like, how do you define affordable healthcare? Which I thought was a great question.
That is a great question.
And I would have loved to have known the answer at the time. So it literally got within one. And it was wrapping up, and that's when he decided to add, and I never asked the press secretary, but I'm almost sure this is what happened. I think he just decided to, at that point, he wanted to kind of ad-lib it. And he asked a question of a reporter from Chicago, and that's who asked him about the Henry Louis Gates thing. And the entire press conference, he'd given like a seminar on healthcare policy, which I don't think anyone else appreciated, but I personally was like, this dude knows his stuff, because I knew all this stuff. And I remember as soon as he got the question on Henry Louis Gates, and as soon as he started to answer it rather than saying, I don't want to talk about it, like, this is all we're going to be talking about tomorrow.
Yep. And that was the headline news.
It was Fox News, Chiron, everything.
I just went back to go look at Politico 2009 coverage just because I'm so fascinated by these like cultural turns. And it's like in retrospect, that really was everything. Here's what I want to get to, just to bring it back to Obamacare, just because it has literally dominated so much of our political lives, which is that you answered this a bit in terms of successes. What is left, quote unquote, to be solved? Because I think there is this myth that there are like mass numbers of people who don't have health insurance. And there are like people who don't have health insurance, but like a vast majority of Americans have health insurance. To me, it seems to be a question of cost, of healthcare inflation, and a question of middle class anxiety. When you especially put healthcare cost inflation relative to wages and then general opportunity, especially when you include young people within that. So if you were to describe the healthcare problem set of 2021, what would it be?
So I would say it is, I am Mr. The Affordable Care Act made a huge difference and we have fewer uninsured. We still have a lot of people, right? I mean, we're still at 10% of the non-elderly population. That's a lot of people who don't have health insurance. On top of that, you have a lot of people with health insurance that's got very high deductibles, the premiums are high. And that isn't just people in the exchange who are buying, you know, coverage through Obamacare exchanges. So the people with employer insurance too, increasingly. Yes. It's confusing. And as you say, the cost is really high. Now, so, you know, the one way to really, you know, there's sort of two ends you can work at this from. So one is to reduce the cost, right? We could just get healthcare costs down. If we could snap our fingers tomorrow and reduce healthcare spending in the United States from 18% of GDP to like 13% of GDP or even 15%, which would still be more than they pay in Europe, but a lot less, you know, many more people could afford insurance, employers could pick up a bigger share of their employees' coverage. And so there is no easy way to do that. I am bullish on ideas like, you know, having the government set prices and budgets like they do overseas, which is what you would have, among other things, in a Medicare for All system. I think that's a great way to go and get to, but like, you can't just walk to the hospitals of America and say, hey, guess what? We're going to cut your fees by 20% next year. Mm-hmm. At best case scenario, that's going to be a slope. It's going to take a few years to kind of get those costs under control. So until you get to that point, or even when you get to that point, you got to work on the other side of it. You got to get more people covered and you got to help people more. And you do that in two ways. So what I mean, number one, you give people assistance. We see that in the COVID relief package started that work. For 2 years, people buying on the Affordable Care Act exchanges are going to get a lot more help. So if you're already getting a tax credit that discounts in your insurance, you're going to get a bigger tax credit.
Got
if
it.
You didn't get a tax credit before, chances are now you'll at least get some. And really, the goal is that no one's insurance would cost more than like 8.5-9% of their income, which is a lot, but you know, lower than it was. And then, you know, the next step is we got to make that permanent because it's only 2 years. But also, okay, what about people who have employer coverage and can't afford, you know, for can you somehow get that kind of assistance to them? And you know, and how do you get more people? And then, you know, how do you get more people enrolled? You know, what kind of mechanisms are there? Because there are people just falling through the cracks. A lot of them are eligible for Medicaid. You know, automatically enrolling people in the Medicaid program would do a lot of good. You know, there are various ideas about that. I will tell you, everything in healthcare is complicated. There's no such thing as a simple idea in healthcare. Even the simple ideas are not simple, but you could certainly do that. So, I mean, I think long run, you got to get the costs down and we should be working aggressively to get the cost down. But best case scenario, that is a long-term project of years, maybe many years. And you can't just wait for that to be done. So in the meantime, you really do have to work. You got to get people more help. We seem to be taking some steps down that road. Obviously, how far down that road we go is waits to be seen.
Yeah. For our last section, let's discuss we're going to go for really cheesy metaphors, the elephant in the room. What happened with the Republican Party and Obamacare? I know this is a whole section of the book, obviously. And it's the part that relates everything wonky we're talking about healthcare to the broader focus of the show, which is a political realignment, which you need to conceive around the parties changing, which parties are capable of implementing what, which coalitions they serve, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So what happened for Republicans? I mean, we've talked about it, but in many ways, Obamacare, from the second that Mitch McConnell said, we are going to oppose this. This is the central organizing principle of the Republican opposition to President Obama. If you think about where were one of the few areas where Trump and the Republican establishment, where were they in agreement in 2015, 2016? Obamacare. Republicans then take the presidency, they have the House, they have the Senate. How did this 10-year project effectively end in total failure and the almost certain, barring a couple of Supreme Court cases, perpetuity of the law?
Yeah. So the party has
perpetuation of the law. I need to correct that.
Right. I know what you meant. So, you know, there's this transition we talked about, right? And the party, you know, is becoming more unified in its opposition to Obamacare. One metric I use is that Jim DeMint, who was the leader of conservatives in the Senate in 2010, he files a bill to repeal the ACA. It's like a one sentence bill. It's repealed. And it has a handful of sponsors. I can't off the top of my head remember how many. He introduces the same bill in 2011 after the new Congress has been set. And every single senator in the Republican caucus joins that bill.
Yep.
And they're all against it. So they've now taken a position completely against the Affordable Care Act and really against universal health care, because there's only so many ways to get to universal health care. And basically, Democrats co-opted the conservative road there. I mean, we were talking before about the Heritage Foundation, whether it was realistic to expect Republicans would support it. But the fact is, if you want to get to universal health care, there's only so many ways to do it. And the Affordable Care Act is about the most conservative way you could do it. So if that wasn't acceptable.
Because you covered over something which people may miss. Why does it matter that it was repeal and not replace when it came to Jim DeMint making that statement?
Yeah. So, I mean, from the very beginning, you know, there's a sense among at least some Republicans that, well, now this thing is here. We got to say we have something else. So the slogan early is repeal and replace. We're going to repeal and we're going to replace the Affordable Care Act. That was the goal. Mm-hmm. But they never had a replace. They never had a plan. And the reason they didn't have a plan is that it wasn't like there were no ideas out there. You had conservatives who work in think tanks, right? Who were working up white papers. And there were like members of Congress, like Senator Orrin Hatch or Congressman Tom Price, who goes on to serve in the Trump administration, who actually wrote bills and they cared about this stuff and they worked on it. But you know, health any policy is hard. Healthcare policy is really hard because there's like what you want to do, and then there's translating it to legislation. And you quickly find out everything's more complicated than you thought. And you got to sort of account for, well, what's the Congressional Budget Office going to say this thing is going to do? And oh, wait a minute, like half my party wants to do one thing, half my party wants to do something else. And oh, by the way, like the drug companies are out there, they want X, and the hospitals are out there, they want Y. People have this kind of insurance and that kind of insurance. And then there's like all this regional stuff that like no one ever talks about. Just layers of complication, layers that basically... One of the reasons Democrats, we talked about that Democrats got across the finish line because they cared so much about it. The other reason was they spent 10 years preparing for that. Like they worked all that stuff out. They did the like unglamorous, grinding, hard work of like having discussions and convening meetings and going through white papers and all that boring stuff that actually matters. And so that they were ready to hit the ground running in 2009. They were all on the same page. They are like, okay, this is what our plan is going to look like. And we have some sense of what it's going to do. And we're basically behind it. And even then they almost didn't get it passed, right? But they had all that. Republicans get to 2017. They've done none of that work. They haven't done the hard work because it would have been hard. You know, it would have been complicated. They would have had to do something about the fact that, well, half this party like thinks the welfare state should like be blown out of existence. Half the party is like, oh, well, you know, maybe we should keep some parts because my constituents like it. And like there was part of the party that frankly just didn't care. There's in general, I have quotes from Republicans like, Republicans don't do healthcare. They don't care about healthcare. And that's like not me. That's like former Republican staffers saying that. And then meanwhile, the whole time you have Republicans promising this great alternative, especially Trump, who's like, we'll have great healthcare for everybody. It'll be cheaper. It'll be better. And, you know, they get to 2017 and there's the promise, better healthcare for everyone, the replace part. And the reality, which is they don't have a replace. They have is some plans they take off the shelf that inevitably, because they're conservative plans, there's less spending, there's less regulation. And it turns out that if you spend less money, you do less regulation, you're going to end up fewer people going to have health insurance. And you can make, if you're a conservative, like, I could make a very coherent argument for why that's a better path to go. I don't believe it, but I can make it. There's a coherent argument, an intellectually honest one. You can find people like Jim Capretta, Michael Cannon, who I talk about in my book, Tom Price, I think would make this argument. But that was not the argument they were making. And these two things clash with each other. They discovered very quickly that the party was all over the place. They hadn't figured out what their consensus was. They hadn't negotiated with the outside groups. They hadn't accounted for the fact that, wait, you mean like the people we're taking insurance away from are going to care? Because of course they were getting all the news from Fox, where like no one on Fox ever talked about the fact that whatever, however problematic Obamacare was, there were lots of people who liked it. You had no sense. I mean, even like when they like met their enrollment goals, like Fox wouldn't talk about it.
Yeah.
And so I think they were just not ready. They didn't know what they were doing. And fundamentally, what they were proposing to do was way out of whack with what they were promising, which they were promising because they knew that's what the American people wanted. And, you know, that's just, you could, despite all that, like, let's be honest, they got pretty close, but they didn't succeed.
Mm-hmm. Can you answer this for me? If there's one thing which is permanently imprinted in my mind as like a Republican policy position on healthcare, it's repealing the inability to buy healthcare across state lines. You read a David Frum book from 2007, he'll talk about it. Trump was really into the Lion Saga. I think you have a story on this too.
He'd be like, the lines between the states at the same conference where he said, quote, and this is my favorite one, nobody knew healthcare would be so complicated. And I was like, actually, it's like, actually, dude, literally everyone knew.
So could you just explain this?
Two books I wrote on it.
So could you just explain the state lines thing? This is just like personal question.
I didn't get it either. Yeah.
Yeah. So let's stipulate that Donald Trump had no idea what he was talking about. He's the most policy-free president. I mean, there's scenes in my book of him negotiating, and it's like comical to put those aside. You know, Obama was like deep in the weeds of like regional reimbursement rates and stuff. And Trump's like, no one ever asked him, explain the difference between Medicare and Medicaid. I'm sure he couldn't do it. Like just, there was just, did not understand it. So let's leave him out because there is a coherent argument here. So the argument on state lines, this goes back to, it's a weird argument because it's really more about a pre-Obamacare world anyway. But the basic idea is that insurance for people who buy coverage on their own is regulated at the state level.
Yeah.
Traditionally. Now, the federal government has, thanks to the Affordable Care Act, has put some overarching standards that now apply. But before that, it was all done at the state level. And, you know, so if you lived in a state like Massachusetts, or, you know, California or Maryland or a liberal state, chances were good there were more regulations, because in general you had legislators like, huh, we think, you know, like we want to make sure the plans cover diabetes care and there should be prescription coverage and maternity coverage and you shouldn't be able to be kicked off your plan. Now, different states were different levels, and sometimes conservative states had it. And a lot of these regulations, frankly, had less to do with what was good for the patient and more to do with which provider group had a lot of lobbying power. So, you know, the sort of podiatrists were very powerful. And guess what? Insurance in Minnesota covers podiatry. Okay.
You never think of the podiatrists as the lobby of power.
You don't, but you know what? I as a runner, like a podiatrist is like, you know, like I've like, thank God for my podiatrist, because like saved my running. So the theory was, and this is true, by the way, is that, well, those regulations make your insurance more expensive. They do, right? I mean, if your policy has to cover this thing, then by, you know, someone's got it. That means the insurance company is forking over the bills to pay for this. Yep. They're not going to eat that cost. They're going to pass it along. So it's premiums. So like, let people, you know, if you let people buy across state lines, which you can't do, then let's say you live in Minnesota and you don't want to pay for your podiatry. Well, but guess what? In North Dakota, the policies don't have to cover podiatry. So I can get a policy from North Dakota. So the problem is like, that's, you know, you undermine all the regulations. So North Dakota, you know, is what in theory, if you take this to its logical conclusion, you end up with a world kind of like credit cards are, where basically all the insurance companies go to North Dakota and they live by the North Dakota rules. And suddenly you can't get policies that like have maternity coverage, and you can't get policies that have prescription coverage. Now, as a practical matter, because it's healthcare, and yes, Donald Trump is very complicated, but a lot of people have looked at this and said, you know, at the end of the day, it's not clear how much that's going to happen for various reasons. The way insurance works, like, it's actually really hard to run an insurance policy from another state because of the networks and such and such. So it's not clear like whether it would really happen. But in general, I think it's fair to say that if you're doing across the state lines, it's a way to undermine regulation. And the problem, basic concept of healthcare insurance, is you want people in one pool. Anything that moves you to more separate pools, you're separating people by their risk. And it ends up in a world where people who have more medical conditions pay more for their bills, which is kind of the opposite, if you believe in universal healthcare, of what you should be doing.
So final cues here, really, which is that we can't talk about healthcare without talking about Senator Bernie Sanders. So how did Bernie Sanders, the 2016-2020 presidential campaigns, both failures, but still popularization of Medicare for All within the Democratic Party, think M4A has 130 co-sponsors or something in the House, which is a lot, and not necessarily any real support in the Senate there. How did he change the healthcare conversation, both on the right and on the left?
Yeah. So Bernie, let's start by giving, let's note that Medicare for All was the original idea for universal coverage. Harry Truman's idea for it was, and it basically fell out of fashion, and it's now back in fashion in a very big way. And while there's no single person responsible for that, certainly there's no person more responsible for that than Bernie Sanders. And that is because he has persistently argued for it. And then as he became more popular, used his popularity and his arguments, he's very good at arguing this, I think, to give the idea a new life. And that's doesn't happen that much in American politics. So
no,
like that, that is to his credit, I think, enormously. I do remember there was a time in 2016 and 2017 where a lot of people who were liberals who were very worried about the future of the Affordable Care Act and the possibility of repeal felt like he was undermining the defense of it. You know, because he spent the 2016 campaign beating up on Hillary Clinton for not being good on healthcare. And whatever you can say on about Hillary Clinton, I mean, no one lives and breathes healthcare more than Hillary Clinton. She had some, you know, she has her reasons for not thinking Medicare for All worked, but like, you know, very dedicated to the cause. And there was a moment in 2017 when he jumps out after the first repeal vote fails and he's out with his Medicare for All plan again. And the thing almost came back from the dead, repeal. And so there was some concern. But I do think, you know, allowing for that, he did elevate the cause. He has pointed us in that direction. I think he's making very good arguments on the merits for like why a Medicare for All system would be better. I love the moment, I don't know if you remember, in the 2020 primaries, I'm pretty sure it was 2020, I'm getting old, I like forget these things, where he's like at a town hall for Fox, and like the Fox hosts think they have a gotcha because they're like,
oh, yes.
Who wants to give up their employer policy? And he says, let's ask who wants to give up. And everyone's like, I'm happy to give it up for Medicare for All. Now, to be fair, I think anyone who's looked at Medicare for All knows it's so much harder to actually get that through the legislature once you move past the abstract. To be fair to Bernie Sanders, he knows that. Bernie Sanders voted for the Affordable Care Act. He could have held the whole thing up for a ransom that was unrealistic. And what did he do? He asked for money for community health clinics to get poor people health care. You look at Bernie Sanders right now, he's not holding up the Biden administration saying demanding universal, you know, Medicare for all right away. He wants incremental changes that move us towards Medicare for all, which to my mind is the best, most likely way to get there. So I think Bernie Sanders, it's interesting. He has this reputation earned of being like a gadfly who like is not, you know, I'm not a backslapper, but he's pretty savvy too. And I look where the debate is today. And I think we have a long way to go before politically we're at Medicare for all, although I could be wrong about that. But the extent that we're much closer than we were, I think he owns a big part of that.
So absolutely. Let's close with this then. I look at this history, and we didn't get into it during the episode, but the book talks about the evolution from Truman, Reagan, and LBJ in the 60s to the possibility that there could have been some form of bipartisan coalition of Richard Nixon and Ted Kennedy, Clinton Care, Obamacare, no Republican repeal. I look at that history and just conclude some form of government-sponsored universal coverage beyond Obamacare just seems inevitable to me, given the dynamics of the Republican Party, given the fact that this seems to just be a clear high priority for parts of the Democratic Party. Is that correct? Is that incorrect? Nothing's inevitable, obviously, but I just can't look at the incremental. I guess the better way to put this is if there's a place where the center left can argue to socialists that incrementalism does actually seem to work, it would seem to be healthcare policy. Maybe not on the right time scale for everyone, but just what's your general characterization of that perception of mine?
Yeah. Inevitable is a big word. Like, I don't know if I buy inevitable unless you're dealing with a really long time frame.
Yeah. So time frame, because the key thing about, like, because this is why I don't think the time frame matters that much.
Yeah.
If you listen to Reagan's arguments in the 1960s, if you look at the Republican arguments in the 2010s, it's specifically that universal coverage, especially this government run, will fundamentally transform this country in a really negative way. So given the apocalyptic nature of the critique, it would seem to me if we're concerned about America, if we're concerned about the country, let's assume every single thing Republicans say about this issue is totally correct. We should care whether it's in 2050, 2020, or 2080, from my perspective.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think we are going to keep moving in the direction of more government control over healthcare. I do. I think that's the direction we're going. And I think the policy lessons from the Affordable Care Act all point in that direction. I think that's where the energy of the Democratic Party is. And I think that's what the American people are trending towards. I think we are coming out of, and it's hard to be sure about this, and there's so many variables, but I do feel like we're swinging away. You know, in the book, I really try to put this in the context of the broadest political trends of American society. And if you think of this sort of New Deal era of faith in government and enthusiasm for new programs, that then ends around the 60s for a variety of reasons we've all discussed. And then this sort of Reagan era that I think we're just now really coming out of. I think in 92, people thought we were coming out of it, and then we weren't. And then I think in 2009, people thought we were coming out of it, and no, we weren't. But I think we might actually be coming out of it now. I think the pandemic has something to do with that. And this could go either way, but I just feel like we're going to keep heading in that direction. I think at the end of the day, Americans value healthcare. We're not going to backslide on this. I doubt. I think like the political verdict has been rendered on the Affordable Care Act, right? I mean, I just think repeal is not popular. It blew up in the Republicans' faces. Their solutions, their conservative ideas appeal to a narrow group of people, but I don't really think they have broad appeal. I mean, the usual Republican argument comes down to, hey, you can shop more. We can do more consumer. Who the heck wants to shop for their insurance? Nobody likes shopping for their insurance.
The worst.
And Democrats are like, hey, you know, we're going to give you this sort of good plan. So I just think that's a more appealing argument. And I think we will move in that direction. Although it's hard because of all the traditional forces that we're in Truman's way, we're in Johnson's way, we're in Clinton's way, we're in Obama's way, and they'll be in whether it's Biden's ways or Kamala Harris's ways or whoever's, you know, I don't know who's going to be president in 2040 or beyond or anything like that.
Well, Jonathan, I can't tell you how much I learned from the book and just from this episode. It's been great talking to you. We really appreciate it. We encourage everybody to go out and buy the book. We'll have a link to that in the bookshop, in our show notes, and elsewhere. Is there anything else that you want to plug while you're here?
That's it. This was a lot of, this is a really good conversation. That was a lot of fun. So I really appreciate your inviting me on the show.
Absolutely. Thanks, Jonathan. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
All right.
Thanks for listening to the episode, guys. We really appreciate it. As always, check out our bookshop, which is linked in our show notes, where you can go ahead and purchase Jonathan's book and or any of the other guests that we've had here on the show. You guys have been buying a lot of awesome books. I've been checking it out. Been really impressed, frankly, with what everybody is reading. So go ahead and click that link in the show notes. As always, a special thank you to the Lincoln Network for sponsoring this podcast. We really appreciate all the work they let us do here, and we will see you all next week.